Good morning, diners and travelers, and holiday makers. I hope you've all had a great run at the holidays. We're almost through. Good morning, Peter. How are you holding up?
I'm holding up just fine, but there is one more holiday to go.
And we thought we'd sort of spice up the coming year.
Oh, we're spicing it up, huh?
Yep.
There you go. And first up, we should also note this is the last program for 2008.
This is true.
Completing almost 5 years of On the Menu Radio, and we're so glad that you're with us for this.
It is completing rather, 5 years, actually.
It's practically our fifth birthday, which is barely startling when you look at us, but there you go. That's the way it is. Anyway, as Anne said, it's a spicy program today, and what better place to start off a spicy program than the island that's only 96 miles from Key West, Florida?
Cuba.
You guessed it, of course. It's Cuba. And a chef who decided to write a book dedicated to the cuisine of that country that she loves so much.
Actually, she's not a chef. She's a lawyer.
Okay.
She's a Cuban, raised in Miami.
She must be something of a chef if she wrote a cookbook.
Uh-huh. Well,
we'll see. She explains it all to us in the interview.
She does cook.
We're in for a treat today, listeners. We have a lawyer who has written a book on Cuban cuisine that is heralded as the most authentic book that's ever been done. Her name is Ana Quincoces. Did I do that? Rodriguez. Did I do that, Ana?
Perfectly.
And the book is called Sabor, which is what? Flavor?
It means flavor.
Flavor. And subtitle, Passion for Cuban Cuisine, which explains why my husband was saying that I was talking very loud today, because as you pointed out, when you're talking about Cuban cuisine, you get loud and excited.
Is that what happens?
Yeah.
But your day
and
job...
after you eat it, you get even louder.
But your day job is a lawyer, so why a cookbook?
Well, you know, it's funny. Now I kind of see myself as a cookbook author that happens to be a lawyer, not the other way around.
Oh,
I think that my job is a little boring. Okay, I'll say it, boring. I'm not the kind of lawyer that gets into court every day and, you know, fights the battles that you see on, you know, Perry Mason or in any of those old-time programs. I'm a real estate attorney. I do bankruptcy. So it's a little...
You must be
not a lot of now. Exactly. Not busy with the real estate, very busy with the bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy, right.
But I didn't feel that I had a creative outlet in my day job. I had always had a passion for cooking. Cooking is just, for me, not only a creative outlet, but it's also something that I found very soothing and stress-relieving at the end of the day. The reason I chose Cuban food is because I'm first-generation Cuban-American. Both my parents are Cuban. Emigrated here in the 60s.
And you would have grown up in the midst of...
I was supposed to be born in Cuba, actually, when you think about it, because considering my parents' age, I should have been born over there. My mother had a little difficulty getting pregnant and got married and for 15 years couldn't get pregnant.
Oh,
so I always tell her I was worth the wait.
Oh, wow.
Not so sure she agrees.
Are you an only child then, Anna?
No, I have a younger brother as well.
Wow.
He's 4 years younger than I am, and he's also an attorney, and he likes to cook too. Not as much, obviously not enough to go out and write a book, but my mother was always an excellent cook. Our house was where all the parties took place, where all the cooking happened, and I grew up seeing that, and I liked that. I liked that whole, you know, feeling of everybody comes to our house to be, you know, nurtured and nourished. It's just, I think that's a very nice concept, so.
And that's kind of built into this cuisine, isn't it?
It really is. It really is, because Cuban food is comfort food at its best.
Yes.
I mean, there's, you know, it's not low calorie, it's not low carb, it's not any of that stuff, but it's not meant to be. It's not probably not meant to be eaten every day, but it's certainly, if you're going to do Cuban food, then do Cuban food.
Do it right.
I have two daughters, two teenage daughters. Well, not so teenage anymore. They're up there already, 17 and 18 years old. And, you know, it's funny, most in Cuban culture, when a girl becomes of a certain age, usually when she's going to get married or go off to college, your mom gives you this cookbook, this Cuban cookbook called Cocina Criolla by Nita Villavol. It's a very famous, kind of like the Bible of Cuban cuisine.
Yeah. I mean, every ethnic cuisine sort of has this. I mean, there's...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it was handed to my mother.
In your book, Anna, you mentioned two of them. Is this the pink one?
Yes, it's the pink one, exactly.
Well, tell me about that.
Yeah, she mentions two Cuban cookbooks in the book.
Right,
and,
I do.
She says both of them are somewhat limited because they're sort of out of date and they're in Spanish and all the ingredients. Metric measurements, so they're really not very helpful, but you get one anyway.
Oh, yeah, I have one because it was given to me by my mother, and it's covered in, you know, contact paper, and I have it for nostalgic purposes. I mean, and
right.
I do refer to it every once in a while, but they're hard to cook from. They're not very user-friendly, and I knew that I would be the last generation to ever open this book. If I gave that book to my daughters, and of course I will give it to them just for them to have it, but that they would not cook from it. And I thought, you know, I need to put a book out there that will appeal to a younger generation, that they can say, oh, okay, this is what real Cuban cuisine is, because there's so many books out there that try to fuse together all different types of cuisine. And while that's delicious, because I love, you know, Pan-Asian cuisine and things with Latin influences and Southwestern influences, but true, authentic Cuban cuisine, there aren't that many books out there like that. They kind of have this vision where that you add a little bit of mango sauce to anything and suddenly it's Cuban. And real Cuban food has no mango sauce, so I thought, okay, I need to put this in a way that will appeal to them, and I think that I've done that. I think the book is doesn't read like an encyclopedia. It's really a compilation of you know, recipes, but interspersed between that, there's lots of interesting stories and anecdotes about growing up Cuban that if you are Cuban, you'll definitely recognize. But even if you're not, you kind of take a voyeuristic peek into this kind of life, and it really helps you enjoy the cuisine a lot more when you understand it. At least I know that's the way it is for me when I cook other ethnic cuisines. I like to know the story behind it and why they made this and what, you know, how that came about.
I can anticipate cooking from it and having something burn because I'm reading one of the stories, but I particularly liked the Eau de Cuba.
Oh, yeah, Eau de Cuba.
Can you explain that? And may not have seen that.
Well, basically, and it has nothing to do with burning, but, you know, in a Cuban household, the cooking always started very, very early, and I always talk about how, like, you know, people wake up to an alarm clock. I would wake up to the little sound that is emitted from a pressure cooker, the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. You know, this is the sound that I would wake up to every morning, because in my house, they always, in many Cuban households, they always made some kind of bean dish, and so that was the noise I heard in the morning. And, of course, the aromas fill the house. And so that's why I say that it's Eau de Cuban house. You know, you have that smell, and then it sticks to you. And everywhere you go, you know you were either at a Cuban restaurant or cooking Cuban. And if you live in a house where cooking went on all the time, the smell never really went away.
Do you have a little bit of Cuban cigar tobacco smell in there as well, or is that passing anymore?
Especially when you're doing the roasted pig, that of course that's all manned by men.
Yeah.
They're just surround the pig and make sure everybody putting in their 2 cents worth. There's always cigar smoking at that time. So yeah, you get that whole cigar element as well.
Now, tell us, what makes Cuban bread so special? We told you about we would go with my brief cousin-in-law, briefly cousin-in-law, to Union City, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
to buy all the ingredients for his Cuban cooking, and particularly you had to buy the bread. I mean, a Cuban sandwich was not a Cuban sandwich without this right bread. Now, what makes it different?
I think that because it kind of, you know, like a bagel, it's kind of boiled over, not immersed in water, but it's kind of boiled with a pan underneath, kind of like a bain-marie over that, and then baked. It has this kind of texture inside that you can pull it, and it's very dense on the inside. In fact, you know, it's very common in Cuban families that they'll grab the Cuban bread and hollow it out while it's still warm and eat the insides, and then you end up with this, you know, in my house, it's like, okay, who hollowed out the bread? And it could have been anybody because, you know, that's how it is. And then the outside, while it does have a crunch to it, it's, you know, it's just kind of very mild and it lends itself very well to whatever you put in it. It doesn't have a very strong taste.
And then, of course, you have to press the bread when you're making a Cuban sandwich.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We had my cousin had wrapped a brick in aluminum mm-hmm. foil.
Let me tell you. I have old Chicago bricks at home that I wrap them. Sometimes I'll use them to make chicken on the grill to do that, like, and for sandwiches are great. Or you can use a cast iron pan and put it right on top of another pan. And that makes a great sandwich press.
Because you can, you have to have a media noche every night.
At midnight.
So especially
if you've gone out drinking, they say that that's the greatest hangover remedy is a media noche.
And so all the classics are there, like ropa vieja.
Mm-hmm.
And
which
the picadillo, which Pepe used to make picadillo all the time, if you remember.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah.
And,
I have the recipe for that,
because
too.
Black beans with everything?
Black beans with everything, absolutely.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, even in Guatemala, I think I ate black beans 3 times a day.
Yeah. Red beans are very good, too. The red beans are like a meal in itself, because you add chorizo to that and potatoes and the calabaza squash, and that with just a little bit of rice, that's a meal. It's very good.
The pork has a very special place. We mentioned that briefly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the whole roast pig is a real production, isn't it?
It is. It's a production. It's a tradition that's handed down from generation to generation. It's a 3-day process from the, you know, when you go to the pig penitentiary, which is what I call it, and pick out your little pig and then, you know, bring him home and hose him down. And I used to be really offended by the whole process when I was older, younger. And now I figure, well, I guess I'm higher up on the food chain. That's just the way it is, you know.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, and then you have to let it sit out overnight, marinating with lots of, you know, sour orange and garlic. And then the next day you get, everybody comes over and, you know, sits around this pig. There's a thing called la caja china. I don't know if you've heard of it, because a lot of times they used to do it, at least when I was growing up. My dad had a pit that he had made with bricks. Other people do a pit in the ground with these special grates. But, you know, unless you're very, very, very good at that, you end up with a charred skin and a raw pig on the inside, which is not pretty.
That's not good, man.
But the gajachina is kind of like an oven created especially for this purpose, and it's been the saving grace for everyone that couldn't make those other things work for them. And the heat comes from the top. You know, you use charcoal and then you turn it every once in a while, and okay. Really you can't mess it up. It's the foolproof way of roasting a pig.
We saw one being made in New Jersey with a gentleman that Aunt mentioned already, and he filled the pit with coals, with charcoal, and I think there was some wood in there as well, but he let it almost, it was almost embers before he put the pig on. And
really? Okay.
But there were sufficient embers that they stayed heating the pig slowly all day long.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was really quite amazing. Now, on another occasion, we had actually told a friend of ours about roasting a pig. So she decided she wanted to roast one, but they had visitors coming from overseas who were from Thailand. Turned out, incidentally, that when the Thais arrived, they were vegetarian.
Oh, no.
But the couple who were the host and hostess took off for the airport to pick up these guests and left me to finish off the pig. So they were very trusting, but I was equal to the task, and it turned out very well.
He's a good pig roaster.
Well, I'm not sure I would do the whole thing, but sometimes you get stuck with it, and that's all you can do.
Well, I keep eyeing up our backyard, Rabbit.
Oh, you do? Okay, well.
And then you have all the wonderful leftovers, which then you put between two pieces of Cuban bread, and then you have a wonderful roast pork sandwich.
Well, Anna, this is a wonderful book. It's so exuberant, and your style is also draws you right into the spirit of the food and the culture. So, listeners, I would recommend that you get Sabor, A Passion for Cuban Cuisine, and it's on our website already, isn't it, Rabbit?
It is indeed. It's on the OTM bookshelf, so go ahead and search down to find it. Place your order through onthemenuradio.com's bookshelf, and away you go. And you'll not only have a recipe book, you'll have a story book about the pride of growing up as a Cuban American and thinking about Cuban roots. One last thing, not on the subject of food, Anna. What do you think will happen under the new president? Do you think this ludicrous embargo will finally be lifted? What's the feeling in Miami?
Oh God, it's hard to say. I even hate to give an opinion about it, because it would be great for many reasons, and then for other reasons you just don't want to give that crazy man over there in Cuba any more power. But I think that hopefully the new president will have the, you know, the wherewithal to figure it all out and make the right decision in the end, and you just have to trust in whoever your leader is, and that's what we got. So,
I've always been dying to go to Cuba. I really would like to go. It's such a beautiful
country. I would love
country.
To go, too. I've never been.
I still am holding on to my stock in the Havana racetrack. My mother put stock in the Havana racetrack.
Yeah, but in the meantime, Anna, you and all of your Cuban-American friends are living in the northern suburbs of Cuba.
Oh, absolutely. If this isn't Cuba, I don't know what is. I mean, my mother, there's this whole thing amongst Cuban. Everything was better in Cuba. The beaches were more beautiful in Cuba.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yes.
Even the plantains tasted better in Cuba. But, you know, we're doing okay over here.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining on the Menu Radio.
Thank you so much. And
thank you for having me. I
hope you have a next adventure creative outlet. Do you have one planned?
Actually, yes, we do. We have one planned. I've been working with an editor. It's kind of in the very raw stages, but we're talking about it.
Let us know.
I will, definitely.
Keep us in mind. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here. Bye, guys.
Bye.
And now it's time for a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Please email us. A greeting would be nice, actually. The address, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Or do you want to do your pitch for the blog, Rabbit?
Yeah, sure. Or you can join our blog at onthemenuradio.blogspot.com. And wish us a happy new day, you there, and give us any suggestions for things that you'd like to have covered in conversation online. Because we're all up to date in On Menu Radio, which is why we have a blog as well as email, and we look forward to hearing from you there. And now, what are we going to do next?
Well, this when you listen to this interview, you'll see how this whole product and the whole experience with the company that makes it was serendipitous to us, because we happen to be rhino lovers. It's a hot sauce it features a product that is predicted to be one of the hot trends, hot in every sense of the word, for 2009, a little tiny African pepper called peri-peri? And peel-peel it is.
I was initially attracted to this next guest and her product by the fact that we had a family connection to an organization that her product contributes to and provides benefit to, Save the Rhino. I want to welcome Jane Caswell?
Yes, hi, Ann. Thanks for having me on your show.
And let's say hello to our second cousin, Joanne Shaw, who's in South Africa working for another organization that saves the rhino, but who ran the New York Marathon in a rhino suit because at the time she was working for Save the Rhino, the cause that Jane supports. And I'm going to, I don't have her email address, but I'm going to send her parents a pointer to this program so that she can listen in and find out about all the great work that you're doing.
Yes, she's wonderful, great. Joe. Okay, now, the name of your company, Jane, is Kalahari Pepper Company.
Yes,
and it's
right.
An African-themed gourmet company. Could you explain to us how one gets into a business like this centered on hot sauce?
Sure. Well, there wasn't really a plan to do that. My husband and I were living in Los Angeles, and we had a dear friend come back from a safari where he just basically observed the peoples and the animals. He wasn't there to kill anything. And he was just fascinated with these little peri-peri peppers, very tiny, flavorful peppers. He brought a few back in his suitcase and spent the next 10, 15 years sort of growing them.
I don't think you should let anybody know about that. That's illegal.
Well, I know. It wasn't back then. You know, you could stuff anything in your pocket.
Really?
Go anywhere you wanted to do. Oh, yeah. I don't think it was a problem back then. You could definitely. You can't even get, an apple across the Oregon border nowadays. But
that's true.
Anyway, he grew these peppers on a little balcony, and the Los Angeles heat and sort of the arid temperature was something that the peri-peri liked. And he just started cultivating the largest peppers and kept the seed bank. And he just had peppers all over his house. They were in every single cupboard. He was basically obsessed. And his mom would come to visit. I just remember her. She's a tiny lady. Just envision her on a step stool opening cupboards to look for pots and pans. He was a bachelor, so she'd try to cook for him. And she said, oh, my God, Phil, there are all these things everywhere, collecting them. So anyway, the three of us sort of put our heads together, and just being young and not knowing what we were doing and really nothing better to do, I guess, decided to, the hot sauce business was really just beginning, and we wanted to do some kind of hot sauce. And so we started sort of experimenting and cooking and really didn't know what we were doing, and ended up with something that we kind of liked, and we had a connection to the Los Angeles Culinary Institute. We sent it over there, and we had a gal work on it, and she basically came up, it took about a year and a half, with what is now, we all know, as rhino sauce. And then the obvious thing was, you know, to come up, it was an African pepper, to have an African theme, and we had all sorts of ideas and thoughts about the company and what we were going to do. Originally, we were going to have all these different products and have different endangered African animals on the label, but the rhino was sort of the first out of the chute, and we just noticed over the years that people would be asking for the rhino sauce, not Kalahari pepper sauce, but the rhino sauce. So we decided that needed to be our brand, and you know, I had about 30 seconds of sadness just because I had all these beautiful drawings of all these other animals, but the rhino, true to its nature, has just been a real great classic, you know, vision for what we do.
They are almost extinct, aren't they? I mean, it's hard to believe.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on rhinos. I know that the Save the Rhino organization, basically what they do is they sort of collect funding and money from all kinds of people and donations, and donate that to certain groups who help conserve the rhinos and conserve really the communities that the rhinos live in the wild. You know, help the people, the indigenous people, protect their own environment and their own species.
They're really odd looking. I'm looking at your label here. They're very odd looking. Are they really practically prehistoric? Huh?
They are from prehistoric times, and what's really sad is that they're slaughtered just for their horn, and their horn is ground into a powder, and it's basically, there's a market in China.
Right, for
and it's
potent.
Considered an aphrodisiac, and it cures all kinds of ills, and of course there's no scientific evidence to that. But
well, they do that with elephant tusks too, don't they?
Yes, well, you know, elephant tusks are, you know, used as jewelry and things, and unfortunately, Africa is such a poor country and such a troubled country. You know, what you can't really blame, in a way, some of the people, their own people who go and kill these rhinos to turn over to just, you know, by the time it gets, they get their little handful of money just to eat. And so there's all kinds of ways, creative ways that they're trying to, Save the Rhino and others are trying to help.
And you donate.
Gone, they're gone.
And you donate proceeds or part of your proceeds from this rhino sauce to the cause.
Yes. And we'll also do that when we come out with our other products, our Bloody Mary mix and our spice rubs. The same goes for them as well.
Now, I want to say something just before we get away with this. This is not just an ordinary hot sauce. This is a very high-quality gourmet product.
Yes, it is. Most hot sauces are mixed together. They're like a vinegar, salt, pepper base. They're mixed together and they're bottled. Ours, we start off with fresh onions, fresh garlic, tomatoes, fresh lemons. The onions and garlic are roasted and blended all together. We put whole lemons in there, grind them up really finely. We use a little bit of canola oil. We use, of course, peri-peri pepper mash. We don't put the fresh peppers in there. The peppers are manufactured into a mash, which is basically just mashed up peppers with a little bit of salt as a preservative. And our product is a cooked product. So, you know, it's about 2 hours of prep time and then about an hour of cooking and blending, and then we bottle it. So
it comes in three different strengths, and as I said to you before we went on air, I tasted the mild, and it was powerful. I don't think I'll ever make it to the hot.
Well, you know, that's true. I prefer the mild myself, but I do a lot of food demos at stores like Whole Foods and Fresh Market and, of course, all the trade shows, and it fascinates me that you never know when someone comes up what their heat level is.
Yeah.
You know, so it is a hot sauce, so there is some fire to it, but there's so much flavor and fresh vegetables and things in there that it's a very versatile product. It's not like a power pack heat, like a Tabasco style sauce at all. So it goes on. It's great on eggs and fish and steak. And I myself am just a horrible, atrocious cook. Just
Oh, that's terrible
at it. And so I will we just use rhino sauce at home all the time. After all these years, I'm not sick of it. And I'll tend to, make a little casserole or a soup that just doesn't quite have a zip to it, and I'll put a little bit of that rhino sauce in there and gives it a special flavor.
Yeah, you sent me a list of suggested uses for it. Do you want to run through some of those?
Well, we're gonna play. Let me ask a question first.
Oh, sure. I'm excluding you. I'm sorry, sweetheart.
No, it's all right. It turns out that on today's menu, at On the Menu Radio in our house, is chili. So the chili recipe calls for ground powdered chilies, but I'm thinking that I might just add a little rhino sauce in there as well, if it doesn't get to quite the right...
A little rhino.
Put a little rhino in it together with the beef.
Yeah, that's right. No, the rhino sauce will do a lot different, give you a lot different flavor, I guess, than the cayenne or the chili pepper powder. You know, whenever you take something like that and you powder it up, and it's amazing to me. I'll look in my kitchen cabinet at home, and there'll be all these spices in there, and there's no dates on them, and they could be 10, 15 years old, and spices lose their potency and lose their flavor after a time, and so if you can use something, that's sort of freshly made and whatever you're doing, it's always better.
I'll make it a little milder than I otherwise might have, and then see if I can kick it up. I hate to say kick it up a notch, because that's somebody else's
right.
Somebody else's shtick.
Yeah. Now, for clarification, you actually don't grow these in Africa. You don't grow them in California anymore either. You grow them in...
Yes, in New Mexico. They're grown for us under contract by a pepper grower, and we have an exclusive arrangement with them. So everything, all the peri-peri peppers that they grow are from our seed bank, and they only grow them for us.
That's amazing. So you maintain the same identical seed bank, huh?
Yes.
Exactly. Now, it's a derived seed bank, though. You said that the person who brought them over, he selected seeds that came from the larger
peppers. The larger ones. The peri-peri peppers in South Africa, for the most part, they just kind of grow everywhere. They're like dandelions. They just grow everywhere. And they're very, very tiny. They're maybe the size of one of your fingernails. They're so little.
Yeah, but that's what most of these, the hottest peppers are the smallest in general, what I understand.
It does seem that way. The Fatale pepper, I know from Africa, is small too.
What's that one called?
The Fatale.
I don't know that one at all.
That's one of our, I guess, our struggles as a company is we have this beautiful peri-peri pepper and products that are made by it, but very few people know about peri-peri. We're all familiar with the habaneros and the red savinas and all those, but that's been, one of our challenges is to kind of introduce this to everybody because they do have their own unique flavor.
Yeah, are they related to the pil-pil stuff?
Yeah, the pili-pili is actually the Portuguese name.
Yes, right.
For the peri-peri, so they're exactly the same thing.
Because Portuguese Portugal used to control the colony where these things grow, right?
Exactly.
Because Angola was a Portuguese colony.
Yes, in fact, there's just a few other peri-peri pepper products in the world market today, and as far as I know, they all use pili-pili pepper ground dried and source them from Portugal. So we're probably one of the few people that actually use the real peri-peri peppers that are grown fresh.
Well, now we've tantalized everybody, so maybe we ought to say how they can get this rhino sauce.
Well, sure, but they can, of course, I'll give my website a plug. You go to www.kalaharipepper.com and you can order, read all about us, read all about Save the Rhino. There are some recipes there as well, and you can order it through our online shopping cart. You can just type in, if you want to just type in Google, Google rhino sauce, there are hundreds of sources for it online. And we do have national distribution, but not to any one store. For instance, we're in a lot of the Southeast Whole Foods stores, but we're not on the West Coast yet. We're in all the Fresh Market stores, which are sort of like a Whole Foods market that are basically east of the Mississippi. We're in quite a few restaurants. We're in all 336 Firehouse sub-restaurants, and I'm not sure if they are national or not. I know they're pretty far-reaching, but they have, you come in and they make a nice fresh sandwich for you, and then they have all these hot sauces on the counter that you can use on your sandwiches, and ours is, I think, number 3 bestseller.
They even
have problems, we've told, with people stealing bottles of rhino sauce out of the restaurant. And we're working with couple of folks at Kalahari Resort is looking at us for bulk rhino sauce to use in their culinary, in their restaurants.
Is that in Africa?
No, that is here in the United States.
It's spelled, by the way, listeners, K-A-L-A-H-A-R-I.
Yes, Kalahari. That's correct.
Which, of course, everyone who studied geography knows is a desert. Is a desert in southern
We're
Africa.
We're getting a history that's lesson.
Right. You're getting a geography. Yeah, you're getting all that
a geography
kind of
lesson.
Now, do you have a store finder on your website?
No, we don't.
Okay.
We're going to add that in. We just launched our new website about 60 days ago. So you know, as anything, you build something and you work on it really hard, and then you look at it and you go, "Oh, we're missing some things here."
Right.
So we're going to be adding that in and adding some photographs, and then I also hope to have some sort of news link. We already linked with Save the Rhino, but I also wanted to just sort of feature some news stories about the rhinoceros on our site immediately, so that you know, in case people leave our site and forget to go to Save the Rhino, they'll come away with some information.
Jane, could I ask you one question here? If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
One of my dreams has always been to grow flowers. And again, I know nothing about it, but I guess I would probably be growing flowers, commercially growing flowers somewhere. I love the country. I love Alabama. It's a beautiful state. And the food industry is fascinating. It always fascinates me when I go to the shows and meet all the different people. And there's so many different facets.
I know. Isn't it
the
truth?
It's great.
And what about your husband? What would he be doing?
My husband actually has a regular day job, because being a real small company like this, all of our the money that we bring in basically goes to developing more products. So right now I'm just kind of running it. He helps me. He does a lot of great stuff for the company, but he has a regular job, and this is actually his dream. I mean, this is something. He loves food. He loves cooking. He's great at the shows. And I'm really more of the administrative person. I'm kind of the first go to Jane if you got a problem kind of thing. And he's really the salesman of the group.
Well, Jane, I hope we meet you at some point, maybe at one of the shows. And do you go to New York for the Fancy Food Show?
Yeah. We are planning to go to San Francisco, not this spring, but the following spring. The show, I don't know if you all ever get to the Atlanta gift show, but they have a huge gourmet food section nowadays. We do that, and then...
I've never been there.
Yeah, it's very good. And I also just attended the gift show up in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and mainly because the zoo and aquarium gift shop buyers hold their convention there during the same time.
Yeah.
And so I was able to connect with a lot of those people. I'm definitely going to be keeping my eye on you too as well. And
okay.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, well, it's really nice to have met you, and I look forward to continuing getting to know you.
Yeah, now Peter's got to go off and make some chili with, of course,
you,
a little rhino salt.
Yeah, go easy with the rhino salt.
Jane, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, and I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we'll take another pause.
For the cause, and of course, we'll expect to see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And now we turn to Hardcore Spice called The Spice Hunter.
This is about the most self-explanatory title for an interview segment you could ever have, because the company's name is Spice Hunter, and we talked to the founder, and we asked her to explain how she got into this business and what they do. And I understand it's not with guns, it's not with bows and arrows, but it's still about finding the most delicious things to season your food, a beautiful thing to think about as we're going into the new year.
Daniela Massey, Product Development Manager of The Spice Hunter. Hello, Daniela.
Hello, Anne.
Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's gobble time again coming up, and one of your products from The Spice Hunter peeling is your unique turkey brine. I'm sure there are lots of other products. Describe that. Our listeners, what exactly the Spice Hunter is about, and then talk about some of the products.
Well, the Spice Hunter manufactures gourmet spices and herbs, and we only sell all natural, which I know that's vague to some people. Natural is kind of used a lot out there. But what it means to us, there's no MSG, there's no preservatives, There's no additives. There's nothing. When you're buying our spices, herbs, and our other line of products, that's what you're getting. Just, we also have a line of 100% organic spices, herbs, and blends. So that's our primary, that's a primary product line. We have some holiday items. We have turkey brine, which we're going to discuss more later. And we also have some meals in a cup, soups in a cup that are dry.
Oh, I think I tasted those at the Fancy Food Show.
Right, and they're really convenient, great to have in your desk, add hot water and let it sit for, 5 to 8 minutes depending on the product, and, you have lunch. We also have risottos in the cup and that sort of thing. But primarily, our main business is our gourmet line of spices and herbs.
How old, Daniela, is this company?
Spice Hunter began in 1980 in Lucia Hunter's spare bedroom, if you can believe that.
So that's the Hunter connection.
Yes, that was her last name at the time. She was married to a Dr. Hunter, and she didn't feel that she could find good, high-quality spices out in the market. And so she started doing spices in a pouch. She also had potpourri and those sort of things, too, along that line, and lots of gift baskets and holiday items.
Oh, how sort of unglamorous. I sort of pictured a spice hunter
in the
rainforest with a butterfly net in one hand and a rifle in the other for shooting herbs and spices.
And that's what I pictured, too.
No, but actually, to that point, we do hunt all over the world for the highest quality and best spices. So although, it came from her last name at the time, and she has since sold the company, but we do, our cloves, our whole cloves come from Penang, an island off of Malaysia, and they are the highest quality. You'll see when I send you some, they're larger, they're plumper, they're more fragrant, and their heads are usually intact. They're just beautiful. And our cinnamon comes from Saigon. Also, only specify a certain cinnamon. We have a high volatile oil content that we have found from that place and that place only, and we have found it best. So we do our oregano comes from a certain mountains in Greece. Our basil comes from California, as our dill does, because we feel that those are best, the highest quality and the most flavor, the best, brightest colors come from California. So we do search, we do hunt all over for the best and the highest quality, and we put it on our label.
Now your role is not on the hunting side, though. You're a product developer, so what that means is that somebody sort of lined up the raw, if you like, the raw ingredients, and then you decide how to blend them together?
Well, actually, my role is a little more expanded in this company than in others. So I actually do source most of the time when it's a new item. I work closely with purchasing and quality control, always in production. But when I'm working on a new product, I'm the one that's sourcing the new items, and then I tell her where we found it, and sometimes we work together and try and, they might have an idea if I'm having a hard time finding something. We're a small company, so we work very closely together.
Now, do you have to go off traveling to try to find out what things are out there?
Yeah, I haven't done, I've done some, I've been to a few places, but the purchasing manager has gone, and when Lucia was running the company, she went all the time. But right now in our main spice category, we feel that we're still of the superior quality, so we haven't actually been searching for something in the main line. The most recent item that we added was smoked paprika.
Oh, I love smoked paprika.
Right, so we did spend some time sourcing that, but as far as going off to faraway places, done a lot of that already, and unless it's a new item that we're thinking of launching, we're pretty much sticking to ingredients and blending things and finding, coming up with great turkey brine for people.
Now tell us, let's talk about, since it is gobble season, what's in your turkey brine to start with? Why is it important to brine? There's a chemical action involved, isn't it? Why do you brine turkey?
Yeah, actually, what happens when you brine, you're soaking in a salt water solution, and the salt breaks down part of the muscle in the meat, which allows the water from the brining solution to enter and to be trapped in there. And then very little of trapped moisture is lost during the cooking. So that's why when you brine a turkey, it is so moist compared to one that is not brined.
This is the method of choice for cooking turkeys these days, right?
It's definitely the popular method of choice. It really does give you an end product that is more moist than not brining at all. I mean, it's, most people complain about especially the turkey breast being so dry and that sort of thing, and this really, it does completely change it. It's actually kind of funny that it's taken us so long to do it. You know, many, many years ago, we preserved lots of things this way.
Uh-huh. Now, what's in, but you've got some things in addition to a conventional brine in this product.
Yes. Ours, first of all, we start with only sea salt. So we have sea salt, and then we add sugar, and we have cranberries and apple, garlic, orange peel. We even have some juniper berries in ours, and then some other spices and herbs.
Now, how much of that makes its way into the turkey?
It's surprising. You do actually, you know, some spices are stronger than others. Some people say, oh, I really taste the rosemary. And what we do when we're testing things is we only brine. So we don't, in our kitchen, we wouldn't add any other spices or herbs. So when we're asking people taste things, it's only what they're getting from the brine. So you do get, you get a saltiness and you get hints of the, you know, the different flavors coming from the fruits or the herbs. It's not strong. So you definitely can, and most people do, also season the outside of the bird afterwards. You know, if they really love rosemary or thyme or sage, or if they want whatever, you know, some people are even using some smoked notes or smoked salts or that sort of flavor in their turkeys.
Perhaps there are even some spice hunter products that would part of that job.
Exactly.
Like give us some examples.
Well, we have a poultry seasoning blend that is all herb. That would be really great. And then we also have one that's called a poultry grill and broil that has more spices, and it has mustard and some other things in it instead of just being all herb. So, or even just simple garlic pepper, which is my favorite blend ever. It's just versatile. You know, you can use it on any.
Now, are you sort of a competitor with Penzies?
Not really, because Penzies is all cataloged. Now, we do, and they do have small, very targeted stores. They're not, you know, nationwide. We're actually on the shelf with McCormick and Spice Island.
Oh, you are? In the supermarket?
Yes.
I see.
So you're really a mainstream product. Having been, company, I guess, has been around a long time.
Yeah, not mainstream enough. You know, those guys are
cute,
we're trying. But the difference is we do state all of our origins. So what that means is we're trapped in that. If there's an availability issue with cinnamon from Saigon, you know, we can't just go get cinnamon from anywhere and throw it in our jar like the competitors would. And we don't use any fillers. Our salts do not have any blends in them.
Yeah, I like the cypress chili salt and cypress rosemary salt.
Okay, now those are in the Flavor Discoveries line, and those are flavored salt. But in our gourmet, our square jar line that's in the supermarket with McCormick and Spice Islands and those companies, there, our blends do not contain any salt, except for we have onion salt and garlic salt. But our other blends, what that means to consumer is they're buying a jar full of high-quality spices and herbs. They've got salt in their cupboard, so they're getting more bang for their buck, and, you know, ours really high quality. We specify high vols oils, and I also have a sensory, and we evaluate blindly against competitors to make sure that ours is of the highest quality.
Sounds like a nicely run company, and I think we should mention that your background is in food science. You have a degree in that, so you know what you're talking about when you're blending up all these flavors.
Yes.
I still like my picture of the spice hunter with a gun and a butterfly net. So you're always going to have that image in my mind.
I can probably find you a picture of Lucia in, you know, similar. I definitely can find you a picture of her to send when she's out in some of the fields. But I'm not sure if she had the gun, but she probably had the hat.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much,
Daniela. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll give you a personal taste test report right after Turkey Day, when we've used this product, which we've been carefully keeping, and we're going to take it with us to South Carolina and insist that our son brine his turkey, which he probably wasn't thinking about doing.
Great. Well, I'll be sure to get some more products off to you, and it was great meeting you. And
Daniela. And
anytime you have any other questions about Spice Hunter or anything else, I'd be happy to help.
Well, I'm keeping you on file here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ann. Thanks, Peter.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, a break one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
here we are again. I guess this is the final segment of our final program for 2008, and we're happy to share that time with our friend Martina from Gustiamo.
Who, of course, has another exciting product adventure for us.
One of our most favorite companies is Gustiamo. It's gustiamo.com for all you internet orders, and we have a partner, co-owner, Martina Kenworthy. I put the I in there again, Martina.
That's fine.
I keep trying to make it Italian, but no, you are Italian.
I am Italian, so the last name is confusing, I guess. But,
right.
You know, I adopted a name.
And your partner, Beatrice.
And Beatrice Ughi is Italian as well, so we are both knit. We have moved to America quite a few years ago, and we were both coming from different businesses, but we have been longtime friends and always interested in entertaining, in cooking, in finding good ingredients. And I guess when we first arrived to America, the situation was a little different. It seemed to me that there was less of an interest in artisanal, pure products that are coming from productions that are old stock production and maintain the integrity. And so we started thinking about going to look for this producer. And what started as a quick idea, just because it was so close to our lives, to what we were doing every day, not necessarily related to our previous careers, became a little business, which is gustiamo.com.
Which means
let's savor together, let's taste together. And I think this is part of our mission, part of what we want to do is being able to explain really well why we think certain flavors, and in particular for Gustiamo.com, we carry only Italian products, are different from others. And, why, if we want to discuss prices, our prices are pretty high. Our products are very expensive, but there are no shortcuts in the production. And so the name of Gustiamo implies also a cultural explanation of what we're doing and what our producers are about and why the products come to be what they are and what we import.
Now, you're in my calendar for this show as the dried porcini interview, not the Martina Kenworthy interview.
No. I wanted to give a brief introduction about Gustiamo, and now we can put the porcini into a larger context.
Okay, that was one of the most recent samples we had with the porcini, the dried porcini.
Yes.
And I was curious if you could explain just a little bit about porcini mushrooms to our listeners.
Absolutely. So porcini. We hadn't carried porcini for a long time because it's hard to find excellent porcini mushroom. There's a lot that is marketed in this country, in Italy as well, as porcini mushroom. It's the scientific name is Boletus sedulis. It's a Latin name, the classification. But most of the porcini you find on the market are a mix of real porcini and other mushroom of lesser quality. The porcini is considered the king of mushroom for flavor, texture. So we were searching in Italy, and we finally found this great little company. They are called Mushroom and Mushroom Porcini from Val di Taro. Val di Taro is where the porcini mushroom, the certified origin porcini mushroom in Italy, comes from.
Now, whereabouts is it, Martina?
Val di Taro is about Emilia Romagna, so not far from Parma, very, very close to the area of prosciutto and parmigiano.
Uh-huh.
But on the border with Liguria, so you really get a climate that it's like a low mountain range climate. It's the Apennines that runs across Italy, and it's where very rich woods of chestnut trees, beech trees, oaks are found in Italy. And this is indispensable for the growth of great mushrooms because, as you probably know, they grow at the bottom of the tree. And there's a process, almost of osmosis, between the growth of the mushroom and the substances that the soil releases under the tree.
Now, this producer, does he also market the mushrooms fresh, or does he specialize in dried?
He specializes in dried. And we do carry another type of, from this producer, the same quality porcini, but in extra virgin olive oil.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And, you know, the dried porcini mushroom, it's easier, obviously, to export. I know that porcini mushroom fresh are exported as well. They're extremely perishable, and I believe are among those products that are
better dried.
Where they are.
Yeah,
you shouldn't try to make and travel too long. But the dried porcini really retain a lot of flavor. In fact, I think in this case, if the quality is really high, they develop a more complex flavor with the drying process.
What other country has a mushroom that you'd compare a porcini to?
Well, I would think that from France, again, there are some areas of production. Maybe we can think of chanterelle mushrooms or cep. You know, there are several varieties that are really porcini one to go. Not only to Italy to find porcini mushroom, but to this specific area. And in fact, in 1993, the Italian government recognized it as a production, I was saying before, it's certified. So they really come with a stamp, and it means there's a consortium that protects the production of this specific area of Italy between Emilia-Romagna and Liguria. And it's the called the porcino from Valtaro, which is the valley where they grow.
Now, can you give us a couple of cooking ideas that
that
you think are really excellent with this kind of product?
Yes. There's a traditional recipe that uses porcini mushroom is the risotto. To keep in mind, porcini are dried, of course, and what we do, we soak them for a very brief time in I put some milk and lukewarm water, so they release the flavor in the water. They of course, develop a softer texture, and then you can drain them and just add them to the classic risotto preparation. But I think because they have such a distinguished flavor, I add them to meat stew, of course, any kind of pasta recipe, both with tomato sauce bases. And alone, you know, you can add some fresh chopped parsley and have tagliatelle, you add a little bit of butter. But to remember always to soak them before, drain them, and then add them to the
I did get a tip from a cookbook somewhere, Martina, that said, be sure not to throw the water away.
Throw the water away, in fact.
So you use that as you add that as a liquid in the cooking process.
I do. And I think that the use of throwing the water away was because some porcini mushroom contain some scent. You know, they're picked, they're clean, but it's hard to clean mushroom in general. So it's nothing bad about the scent that you might find. But definitely you will taste it sometimes if it's in excess. I haven't found this to happen with our porcini still. There might be slight traces, so the water would also, besides making them softer, that would get rid of these traces.
Now, Martina, can you just give us an overview of you do olive oils, you do vinegars, you do salt.
Yes. So we try to represent the typical productions of Italian regions, and so we go from north to south, and Gustiamo selection is pretty varied. It goes from classic Italian staple items, as you said, like extra virgin olive oils, traditional balsamic vinegar, pasta. We have a couple of great artisanal pasta, the Latini from Marche, Martelli from Tuscany. We have coffee from Rome. So we go and try to find really an expression of a particular regional culture made like the old times, you know, where there's no industrial production involved, and the relationship with the producers is key to what we are doing, because we need to trust them, we need to.
And it must be a lot of fun for you, too.
It is a lot of fun, yes. We do, you know, we have a ever-growing selection. We are taking it very slowly, because it's not easy to find what we think it's the best of the best. So, you know, it takes a few trips and establishing relationships, going to visit the producer and making sure that our standards coincide with theirs. And then we bring them back to America. We have a warehouse, and we ship them out.
And how does one access you? Just go on your website?
Yes, it's gustiamo.com, and you can order everything you see on the website. Of course, very fast shipping everywhere in the United States. And
I would suggest also that they get on your mailing list if you have one, because
we do.
Yes, and how does one get on that? Because then you get alerted to the new finds you have or the specials you offer.
Yes, we send out letters, and we try, you know, we definitely do not do spam. We don't spam anyone, and we try to send them out only when we have something important to say, either a product, new product has arrived or it's back in stock. And to do that, there's a tab on our website at the bottom of the homepage that says newsletters. And you can just open that page, put in your email address, and you will start receiving. You will be one of our friends.
And before you go, Martina, we should tell you that a few months ago we finally found the right occasion to use the magnificent red rice that you sent.
Oh, good! I'm glad.
We took it to our son and daughter-in-laws in South Carolina.
I love it.
And we ate it for several days, and it was really excellent.
Oh, wonderful!
We did it with the Parmesan,
it's good in a very simple way too, right? You don't need much because that rice has so much flavor.
Right.
I think it's all it takes. It's a little good olive oil and some Parmigiano, and it is a good product.
I can say honestly that I've never had any product that I haven't liked. Peter, what did you?
No, it's okay.
We are open to feedback.
I'm easily interrupted. It's not a problem. I just wanted to put in a. Do you still have the red rice? I wanted to put in a plug for our listeners just in case.
We do. Yes, we do have red rice, black rice. We have a few new products that just came in a few days ago. We have some wonderful cookies from a bakery in Lazio, near Rome. So you should. And I will make sure that you're in the loop with all the new things that are coming in.
We love it.
Well, Martina, it's always a delight to listen to you. Talk to us, please. Give Beatrice.
Keep in touch.
Please give Beatrice our best wishes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, and happy holidays.
Yes, and you too, and I hope we talk. If not, we see you at the Fancy Food Show every year, but that's a long ways off.
We'll have to talk before that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Martina.
My pleasure.
Ciao.
Ciao, ciao.
Well, thank you, Martina Kenworthy, for finishing out the show. Mrs. Rabideau, a very happy New Year to you. It's been a wonderful pleasure to do this program and the last 5 years' worth. And we'll look forward to starting 2009 afresh, having a wonderful time, probably reporting back on what we've been doing in New Orleans for the holiday season. But you never know, so you'll have to join us to find out. So in the meantime, I guess we should say, for auld lang syne. Maybe we won't sing, Mummy.
That's another story.
Anyway,
right.
happy New Year to all of you listeners at On the Menu Radio, and Happy New Year to Anne.
And to you, Peter. Bye-bye.